This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. The Awakening by Kate Chopin, Chapters 16 to 20. Chapter 16. Do you miss your friend greatly? Asked Mademoiselle Reiss one morning as she came creeping up behind Etna, who had just left her cottage on her way to the beach. She spent so much of her time in the water since she had acquired finally the art of swimming. As their stay at Grand-Île drew near its close, she felt that she could not give too much time to a diversion which afforded her the only real pleasurable moments that she knew. When Mademoiselle Reiss came and touched her upon the shoulder and spoke to her, the woman seemed to echo the thought which was ever in Edna's mind, or, better, the feeling which constantly possesses her. Robert's going had some way taken the brightness, the color, the meaning out of everything. The conditions of her life were in no way changed, but her whole existence was dulled, like a faded garment which seems to be no longer worth wearing. She sought him everywhere, in others whom she introduced to talk about him. She went up in the mornings to Madame Lebrun's room, braving the clatter of old sewing machines. She sat there and chatted at intervals, as Robert had done. She gazed around the room at the pictures and photographs hanging upon the wall, and discovered in some corner an old family album, which she examined with the keenest interest, appealing to Madame Lebrun for enlightenment concerning the many figures and faces which she discovered between its pages. There was a picture of Madame Lebrun with Robert as a baby, seated in her lap, a rounded-faced infant, with a fist in his mouth. The eyes alone in the baby suggested the man. And that was he also in kilts, at the age of 5, wearing long curls and holding a whip in his hand. It made Edna laugh, and she laughed too at the portrait in his first long trousers, while another interested her, taken when he left for college, looking thin, long-faced, with eyes full of fire, ambition, and great intentions. But there was no recent picture, none which suggested the Robert who had gone away 5 days ago, leaving a void and wilderness behind him. Oh, Robert stopped having his picture taken when he had to pay for him himself. He found wiser use for his money, he says, explained Madame Lebrun. She had a letter from him, written before he left New Orleans. Edna wished to see the letter, and Madame Lebrun told her to look for it either on the table or the dresser, or perhaps it was on the mantelpiece. The letter was on the bookshelf. It possessed the great interest and attraction for Edna, the envelope, its size and shape, the postmark, the handwriting. She examined every detail of the outside before opening it. There was only a few lines, setting forth that he would leave the city that afternoon, that he had packed his trunk in good shape, that he was well, and sent her his love and begged to be affectionately remembered to all. There was no special message to Edna except a postscript saying that if Mrs. Pontellier desired to finish the book which he had been reading to her, his mother would find it in his room among other books there on the table. Edna experienced a pang of jealousy because he had written to his mother rather than to her. Everyone seemed to take for granted that she missed him. Even her husband, when he came down the Saturday following Robert's departure, expressed regret that he had gone. "How do you get on without him, Edna?" he asked. "Oh, it's all very dull without him," she admitted. Mr. Pontellier had seen Robert in the city, and Edna asked him a dozen questions or more. Where had they met? On Carondelet Street in the morning. They had gone in and had a drink and a cigar together. What had they talked about? Chiefly about his prospect in Mexico, which Mr. Pontellier thought were promising. How did he look? How did he seem, grave or gay or how? Quite cheerful, and wholly taken up with the idea of his trip, which Mr. Pontellier found altogether natural in a young fellow about to seek fortune and adventure in a strange, queer country. Edna tapped her foot impatiently and wondered why the children persisted in playing in the sun when they might be under the trees. She went down and led them out of the sun, scolding the quadroons for not being more attentive. It did not strike her as in the least grotesque that she should be making of Robert the object of conversation and leading her husband to speak of him. The sentiment which she had entertained for Robert in no way resembled that which she felt for her husband, or had ever felt, or ever expected to feel. She had all her life long been accustomed to harbor thoughts and emotions which never voiced themselves. They had never taken the form of struggles. They belonged to her and were her own. And she entertained the conviction that she had a right to them and that they concerned no one but herself. Edna had once told Madame Ratignolle that she would never sacrifice herself for her children or for anyone. Then had followed a rather heated argument. The two women did not appear to understand each other or to be talking the same language. Edna tried to appease her friend and to explain. I would give up the inessentials. I would give my money. I would give my life for my children. But I wouldn't give myself. I can't make it more clear. It's only something which I am beginning to comprehend, which is revealing itself to me. I don't know what you would call the essentials, or what you mean by the unessentials, said Madame Ratignolle cheerfully. But a woman who would give her life for her children could do no more than that. Your Bible tells you so. I'm sure I couldn't do more than that. Oh, yes, you could, laughed Edna. She was not surprised at Mademoiselle Reyes' question the morning that lady, following her to the beach, tapped her on the shoulder and asked if she did not greatly miss her young friend. Oh, good morning, mademoiselle. Is it you? Why, of course, I miss Robert. Are you going down to bathe? Why should I go down to bathe at the end of the very season, when I haven't been in the surf all summer, replied the woman disagreeably. I beg your pardon, offered Edna, in some embarrassment, for she should have remembered that Mademoiselle Reyes' avoidance of the water had furnished a theme for much pleasantry. Some among them thought that on the account of her false hair, or the dread of getting the violets wet, while others attributed it to the natural aversion for water, sometimes believed to accompany the artistic temperament. Mademoiselle offered Edna some chocolates in a paper bag, which she took from her pocket, by way of showing that she bore no ill feeling. She generally ate chocolate for their sustaining quality. They contained much nutriment in small compass, she said. They saved her from starvation, as Madame Lebrun's table was utterly impossible, and no one save so impertinent a woman as Madame Lebrun could think of offering such food to people and require them to pay for it. She must feel very lonely without her son, said Edna, desiring to change the subject. Her favorite son, too. It must have been quite hard to let him go. Mademoiselle laughed mercilessly. Her favorite son? Oh, dear! Who could have been imposing such a tale upon you? Aline Lebrun lives for Victor, and for Victor alone. She has spoiled him into the worthless creature that he is. She worships him and the ground he walks on. Robert is very well in a way to give up all the money he can earn to the family and keep the barest pittance for himself. Favorite son, indeed! I miss the poor fellow myself, my dear. I'd like to see him and hear him about the place, the only Lebrun who is worth a pinch of salt. He comes to see me often in the city. I like to play with him. That Victor. Hanging would be too good for him. It's a wonder Robert hasn't beaten him to that long ago. But I thought he had great patience with his brother, offered Edna, glad to be talking about Robert, no better what was said. Oh, well, he trashed him well enough a year or two ago, said Mademoiselle. It was about a Spanish girl, whom Victor considered that he had some sort of claim upon. He met Robert one day talking to the girl, or walking with her, or bathing with her, or carrying her basket, I don't remember what. And he became so insulting and abusive that Robert gave him a thrashing on the spot that kept him comparatively in order for a good while. It's about time he was getting another. Was her name Mariquita? Asked Edna. Mariquita, yes, that's it. Mariquita, I had forgotten. Oh, she was a sly one and a bad one, that Mariquita. Edna looked down at Mademoiselle Reyes and wondered how she could have listened to her venom so long. For some reason she felt depressed, almost unhappy. She had not intended to go into the water, but she had donned her bathing suit and left Mademoiselle alone, seated under the shade of the children's tent. The water was growing cooler as the season advanced. Edna plunged and swam about with an abandon that thrilled and invigorated her. She remained a long time in the water, half hoping that Mademoiselle Reyes would not wait for her. But Mademoiselle waited. She was very amiable during the walk back and raved much over Edna's appearance in her bathing suit. She talked about music. She hoped that Edna would go to see her in the city and wrote her address with the stub of a pencil on a piece of card which she found in her pocket. "When do you leave?" asked Edna. "Next Monday, and you?" "The following week," answered Edna, adding, "It has been a pleasant summer, hasn't it, mademoiselle?" "Well," agreed Mademoiselle Reiss with a shrug, "rather pleasant if it hadn't been for the mosquitoes and the Farwell twins." Chapter 17. The Pontellier possessed a very charming home on Esplanade Street in New Orleans. It was a large double cottage with a broad front veranda whose round fluted columns supported the sloping roof. The house was painted a dazzling white. The outside shutters, or jalousies, were green. In the yard, which was kept scrupulously neat, were flowers and plants of every description which flourishes in South Louisiana. Within doors, the appointments were perfect after the conventional type. The softest carpets and rugs covered the floors. Rich and tasteful draperies hung at doors and windows. There were paintings selected with judgment and discrimination upon the walls. The cut glass, the silver, the heavy damask, which daily appeared upon the table, were the envy of many women whose husbands were less generous than Mr. Pontellier. Mr. Pontellier was very fond of walking about his house, examining its various appointments and details, to see that nothing was amiss. He greatly valued this possession, chiefly because they were his, and derived genuine pleasure from contemplating a painting, a statuette, a rare lace curtain, no matter what, after he'd bought it and placed it among his household goods. On Tuesday afternoons, Tuesday being Mrs. Pontellier's reception day, there was a constant stream of callers, women who came in carriages or in the streetcars, or walked when the air was soft and distance permitted. A light-colored muletto boy, in dress coat and bearing a diminutive silver tray for reception of cars, admitted them. A maid, in white fluted cap, offered the callers liqueur, coffee, or chocolate as they might desire. Mrs. Pontellier, attired in a handsome reception gown, remained in the drawing room the entire afternoon receiving her visitors. Men sometimes called in the evening with their wives. This has been the program which Mrs. Pontellier had religiously followed since her marriage 6 years before. Certain evenings during the week she and her husband attended the opera or sometimes the theater. Mr. Pontellier left his home in the mornings between 9 and 10 o'clock and rarely returned before 6:30 or 7 in the evening, dinner being served at 7:30. He and his wife seated themselves at table one Tuesday evening, a few weeks after their return from Grand-Île. They were alone together. The boys were being put to bed. The patter of their bare, escaping feet could be heard occasionally, as well as the pursuing voice of the quadroon, lifted in mild protest and entreaty. Mrs. Pontellier did not wear her usual Tuesday reception gown. She was in ordinary house dress. Mr. Pontellier was observant about those things, noticed it, as he served the soup and handed it to the boy in waiting. "Tired out, Edna? Whom did you have? Many callers?" he asked. He tasted his soup and began to season it with pepper, salt, vinegar. "There were a good many," replied Edna, who was eating her soup with evident satisfaction. "I found their cards when I got home. I was out." "Out?" exclaimed her husband, with something like genuine consternation in his voice, as he laid down the vinegar cruet and looked at her to his glasses. "Why? What could have taken you out on Tuesday? What did you have to do?" "Nothing. I simply felt like going out, and I went out." "Well, I hope you left some suitable excuse," said her husband, somewhat appeased as he added a dash of cayenne pepper to the soup. "No, I left no excuse. I told Joe to say I was out, that was all." "Why, my dear, I should think you'd understand by this time that people don't do such things. We've got to observe les convenances if we ever expect to get on and keep up with the procession. If you felt that you had to leave home this afternoon, you should have left some suitable explanation for your absence. This soup is really impossible. It's strange that woman hasn't learned yet to make a decent soup. Any free lunch stand in town serves a better one. Was Mrs. Beltrop here?" "Bring the tray with the cards, Joe. I don't remember who was here." The boy retired and returned after a moment, bringing the tiny silver tray, which was covered with ladies' visiting card. He handed it to Mrs. Pontellier. "Give it to Mr. Pontellier," she said. So Joe offered the tray to Mr. Pontellier and removed the soup. Mr. Pontellier scanned the name of his wife's callers, reading some of them aloud with comments as he read. The Mrs. de Lacidas. I worked a big deal in futures for their father this morning. Nice girls. It's time they were getting married. Mrs. Belthrop, I tell you what it is, Edna. You can't afford to snub Mrs. Belthrop. Well, Belthrop could buy and sell us 10 times over. His business is worth a good round sum to me. You'd better write her a note. Mrs. James Highcamp. Ugh! The less you have to do with Mrs. Highcamp, the better. Madame Laforce. Came all the way from Carrollton. Poor soul. Mrs. Wiggs. Mrs. Eleanor Bolton's. He pushed the card aside. Merci! Exclaimed Edna, who'd been fuming. Why are you taking the thing so seriously and making such a fuss over it? I'm not making any fuss over it, but it's just such seeming trifles that we've got to take seriously. Such things count. The fish was scorched. Mr. Pontellier would not even touch it. Edna said she didn't mind a little scorched taste. The roast was in some way not to his fancy, and he did not like the manner in which the vegetables were served. It seems to me, he said, we spend money enough in this house to procure at least one meal a day which a man could eat and retain his self-respect. You used to think that the cook was a treasure, returned Edna, indifferently. Perhaps when she was first came in, but cooks are only human. They need looking after, like any other class or persons that you employ. Suppose I didn't look after the clerks in my office, and just let them run things their own way. They'd soon make a nice mess of me and my business. Where are you going? Asked Edna, seeing that her husband arose from table without having eaten a morsel except the taste of the highly seasoned soup. I'm going to get my dinner at the club. Good night. He went into the hall, took his hat and stick from the stand, and left the house. She was somewhat familiar with such scenes. They had often made her very unhappy. On a few previous occasions, she had been completely deprived of any desire to finish her dinner. Sometimes she had gone into the kitchen to administer a tardy rebuke to the cook. Once she went into a room and studied the cookbook during an entire evening, finally writing out a menu for the week, which left her harassed with a feeling that, after all, she had accomplished no good that was worth the name. But that evening, Edna finished her dinner alone, with forced deliberation. Her face was flushed, and her eyes flamed with some inward fire that lighted them. After finishing her dinner, she went to her room, having instructed the boy to tell any other callers that she was indisposed. It was a large, beautiful room, rich and picturesque in the soft, dim light, which the maid had turned low. She went and stood at an open window and looked out on the deep tangles of the garden below. All the mystery and witchery of the night seemed to have gathered there amid the perfumes, and the dusky and tortuous outline of flowers and foliage. She was seeking herself and finding herself in just such sweet half-darkness which met her moods. But the voices were not soothing that came to her from the darkness in the sky above and the stars. They jeered and sounded mournful notes without promise, devoid even of hope. She turned back into the room and began to walk to and fro down its whole length, without stopping, without resting. She carried in her hands a thin handkerchief, which she tore into ribbons, rolled into a ball, and flung from her. Once she stopped, and taking off her wedding ring, flung it upon the carpet. When she saw it lying there, she stamped her heel upon it, striving to crush it. But her small boot heel did not make an indenture, not a mark upon the little glittering circlet. In a sweeping passion, she seized a glass vase from the table and flung it upon the tiles on the earth. She wanted to destroy something. The crash and clatter were what she wanted to hear. A maid, alarmed at the din of breaking glass, entered the room to discover what was the matter. "Oh, a vase fell upon the earth," said Edna. "Never mind, leave it till morning." "Well, you might get some of the glass on your feet, ma'am," insisted the young woman, picking up bits of broken glass that were scattered upon the carpet. "And here's your ring, ma'am, under the chair." Edna held out her hand, and taking the ring, slipped it upon her finger. Chapter 18. The following morning, Mr. Pontellier, upon leaving for his office, asked Edna if she would not meet him in town in order to look at some new fixtures for the library. "I hardly think we need new fixtures, Léonce." "Don't let us get anything new. You're too extravagant. I don't believe you ever think of saving or putting by." The way to become rich is to make money, my dear Edna, not to save it, he said. He regretted that she didn't feel inclined to go with him and select new fixtures. He kissed her goodbye and told her that she was not looking well and must take care of herself. She was unusually pale and very quiet. She stood on the front veranda as he quitted the house and absently picked a few sprays of jasmine that grew upon a trellis nearby. She inhaled the odor of the blossoms and thrust them in the bosom of her white morning gown. The boys were dragging along the banquet, a small express wagon which they had filled with blocks and sticks. The quadroon was following them with little quick steps, having assumed a fictitious animation and alacrity for the occasion. A fruit vendor was crying his wares in the street. Edna looked straight before her in a self-absorbed expression on her face. She felt no interest in anything about her. The street, the children, the fruit vendor, the flowings growing there under her eyes, were all part and parcel of an alien world which she had suddenly become antagonistic. She went back into the house. She had thought of speaking to the cook concerning her blunders of the previous night, but Mr. Pontellier had saved her that disagreeable mission for which she was so poorly fitted. Mr. Pontellier's arguments were usually convincing with those whom he employed. He left home feeling quite sure that he and Edna would sit down that evening and possibly a few subsequent evenings to a dinner deserving the name. Edna spent an hour or two in looking over some of her old sketches. She could see their shortcomings and defects, which were glaring in her eyes. She tried to work a little, but found that she was not in the humor. Finally, she gathered together a few of the sketches, those which she considered at least discreditable, and she carried them with her when a little later she dressed and left the house. She looked handsome and distinguished in her street gown. The tan of the seashore had left her face, and her forehead was smooth, white, and polished beneath her heavy yellow-brown hair. There were a few freckles on her face, and a small dark mole near the underlip, and one on the temple half hidden in the hair. As Edna walked along the street, she was thinking of Robert. She was still under the spell of her infatuation. She had tried to forget him, realizing the inutility of remembering. But the thought of him was like an obsession, ever pressing itself upon her. It was not that she dwelt upon details of their acquaintance, or recalled any special or particular way in his personality. It was his being, his existence, which dominated her thought, fading sometimes as if it would melt into the mist of the forgotten, but reviving again with an intensity which filled her with an incomprehensible longing. Edna was on her way to Madame Ratignolle's. Their intimacy begun at Grandville had not declined, and they had seen each other with some frequency since their return to the city. The Ratignolle lived at no great distance from Edna's home, on the corner of a side street where Monsieur Ratignolle owned and conducted a drug store which enjoyed steady and prosperous trade. His father had been in the business before him, and Monsieur Ratignolle stood well in the community and bore enviable reputation for integrity and clear-headedness. His family lived in commodious apartments over the store, having an entrance on the side within the porte cochère. There was something which Edna thought very French, very foreign, about the whole manner of living. In the large and pleasant salon, which extended across the width of the house, the Ratignolles entertained their friends once a fortnight with a soirée musicale, sometimes diversified by card playing. There was a friend who played upon the cello. One brought his flute and another his violin, while there were some who sang and a number who performed upon the piano with various degrees of taste and agility. The Ratignolle soirées musicales were widely known, and it was considered a privilege to be invited to them. Edna found her friend engaged in assorting the clothes which had returned that morning from the laundry. She at once abandoned her occupation upon seeing Edna, who had been ushered without ceremony into her presence. "Cité can do it as well as I. It's really her business," she explained to Edna, who apologized for interrupting her. As she summoned a black young woman, whom she instructed in French, to be careful in checking off the list which she handed to her. She told her to notice particularly if a fine linen handkerchief of Monsieur Ratignolle's, which was missing last week, had been returned, and to be sure to set on one side such pieces as required mending and darning. Then placing an arm around Edna's waist, she led her to the front of the house, to the salon, where it was cool and sweet with the odor of great roses that stood upon the earthen jars. Madame Ratignolle looked more beautiful than ever there at home, in the negligee which left her arms almost wholly bare and exposed the rich, melting curves of her white throat. "Perhaps I shall be able to paint your picture some day," said Edna with a smile when they were seated. Then she produced the roll of sketches and started to unfold them. "I believe I ought to work again. I feel as if I wanted to be doing something. What do you think of them? Do you think it worthwhile to take it up again and study some more? I might study for a while with Laidpore." She knew that Madame Ratignolle's opinion in such a matter would be next to valueless, that she herself had not alone decided but determined. But she sought the words of praise and encouragement that would help her to put heart into a venture. "Your talent is immense, dear." "Nonsense," protested Edna, well pleased. "Immense, I tell you," persisted Madame Ratignolle, surveying the sketches one by one at close range, then holding them at arm's length, narrowing her eyes and dropping her hand on one side. "Surely this Bavarian peasant is worthy of framing, and this basket of apples. Never have seen anything more lifelike. One might almost be tempted to reach out a hand and take one." Edna could not control a feeling which bordered upon complacency at her friend's praise, even realizing, as she did, its true worth. She retained a few of the sketches and gave all the rest to Madame Ratignolle, who appreciated the gift far beyond its value, and proudly exhibited the pictures to her husband when he came up from the store in a little later for his midday dinner. Mr. Ratignolle was one of those men who are called the salt of the earth. His cheerfulness was unbounded, and it was matched by his goodness of heart, his broad charity and common sense. He and his wife spoke English with an accent which was only discernible through his un-English emphasis, and a certain carefulness and deliberation. Edna's husband spoke English with no accent whatsoever. The Ratignolles understood each other perfectly. If ever the fusion of two human beings into one has been accomplished on this sphere, it has certainly been in their union. As Edna seated herself at table with them, she thought, better a dinner of herbs, though it didn't take her long to discover that it was no dinner of herbs, but a delicious repast, simple, choice, and in every way satisfying. Monsieur Ratignolle was delighted to see her, though he found her looking not so well as Grandil, and he advised a tonic. He talked a good deal about various topics, a little politics, some city news, and neighborhood gossips. He spoke with an animation and earnestness that gave an exaggerated importance to every syllable he uttered. His wife was keenly interested in everything he said, laying down her fork the better to listen, chiming in, taking the words out of his mouth. Edna felt depressed rather than soothed after leaving them. The little glimpse of domestic harmony that had been just offered to her gave her no regret, no longing. It was not a condition of life which fitted her, and she could see in it but an appalling and hopeless ennui. She was moved by a kind of commiseration for Madame Ratignolle, a pity for that colorless existence which never uplifted its possessor beyond a region of blind contentment, in which no moment of anguish ever visited her soul, in which she would never have the taste of life delirium. Edna vaguely wondered what she meant by life's delirium. It had crossed her thought like some unsought, extraneous impression. Chapter 19. Edna could not help but think that it was very foolish, very childish, to have stamped upon her wedding ring and smashed a crystal vase upon the tiles. She was visited by no more outburst, moving her to such futile expedients. She began to do as she liked and to feel as she liked. She completely abandoned her Tuesday at home and did not return the visits of those who had called upon her. She made no ineffectual efforts to conduct her household in bonne ménagère, going and coming as it suited her fancy, and so far as she was able, lending herself to any passing caprice. Mr. Pontellier had been a rather courteous husband so long as he met a certain tacit submissiveness in his wife, but her new and unexpected line of conduct completely bewildered him. It shocked him. Then her absolute disregard for her duties as a wife angered him. When Mr. Pontellier became rude, Edna grew insolent. She had resolved never to take another step backward. It seems to me the utmost folly for a woman at the end of a household and the mother of children to spend in an atelier days which would be better employed contriving for the comfort of her family. "I like painting," answered Edna, Perhaps I shan't always feel like it. Then, in God's name, paint. But don't let the family go to the devil. There's Madame Ratignolle, because she keeps up her music. She doesn't let everything else go to chaos. And she's more of a musician than you are a painter. She isn't a musician, and I'm not a painter. It isn't on account of painting that I let things go. On account of what, then? Oh, I don't know. Let me alone. You bother me. It sometimes entered Mr. Pontellier's mind to wonder if his wife were not growing a little unbalanced mentally. He could see plainly that she was not herself. That is, he could not see that she was becoming herself and daily casted aside that fictitious self which we assume like a garment with which to appear before the world. Her husband let her alone as she requested and went away to his office. Edna went up to her atelier, a bright room in the top of the house. She was working with great energy and interest, without accomplishing anything, however, which satisfied her even in the smallest degree. For a time she had the whole household enrolled in the service of art. The boys posed for her, and though they thought it amusing at first, the occupation soon lost its attractiveness when they discovered that it was not a game arranged especially for their entertainment. The quadroon sat for hours before Edna's palette, patient as a savage, while the housemaid took charge of the children and the drawing room went undusted. But the housemaid, too, served her term as model when Edna perceived that the young woman's back and shoulders were molded on classic lines and that her hair, loosened from its confining cap, became an inspiration. While Edna worked, she sometimes sang low the little air, Ah, si tu savais. It moved her with recollections. She could hear again the ripple of the water, the flapping sail. She could see the glint of the moon upon the bay, and she could feel the soft, gusty beating of the hot south wind. A subtle current of desire passed through her body and weakening her hold upon the brushes and making her eyes burn. There were days when she was very happy without knowing why. She was happy to be alive and breathing, when her whole being seemed to be one with the sunlight, the color, the odors, the luxuriant warmth of some perfect southern day. She liked them to wander alone in a strange and unfamiliar place. She discovered many a sunny sleeping corner, fashioned to dream in, and she found it good to dream and to be alone and unmolested. There were days when she was unhappy, and did not know why, when it did not seem worthwhile to be glad or sorry, to be alive or dead, when life appeared to her like a grotesque pandemonium, and humanity like worms struggling blindly towards inevitable annihilation. She could not work on such a day, or weave fancies to stir pulses and warmer blood. Chapter 20. It was during such a mood that Edna hunted Mademoiselle Reiss. She had not forgotten the rather disagreeable impression left upon her by their last interview, but she nevertheless felt a desire to see her, above all, to listen while she played upon the piano. Quite early in the afternoon, she started upon her quest for the pianist. Unfortunately, she had mislaid or lost Mademoiselle Reiss' card, and looking up in her address in the city directory, she found that the woman lived on Bienville Street, some distance away. The directory which fell into her hands were a year or more old, however, and upon reaching the number indicated, Edna discovered that the house was occupied by a respectable family of mulattoes, which had chambre garnie to left. They had been living there for 6 months and knew absolutely nothing of Mademoiselle Reiss. In fact, they knew nothing of any of their neighbors. Their lodgers were all people of the highest distinction, they assured Edna. She did not linger to discuss class distinctions with Madame Poupon, but hastened to a neighboring grocery store, feeling sure that Mademoiselle should have left her address with the proprietor. He knew Mademoiselle Reiss a good deal better than he wanted to know her, and informed his questioner. In truth, he did not want to know her at all, or anything concerning her, the most disagreeable and unpopular woman who ever lived on Bienville Street. He thanked heaven that she had left the neighborhood, and was equally thankful that he did not know where she had gone. Edna's desire to see Mademoiselle Reiss had increased tenfold since these unlooking-for obstacles had arisen to thwart it. She was wondering who should give her the information she sought when it suddenly occurred to her that Madame Lebrun would be the most likely to do so. She knew it was useless to ask Madame Ratignolle, who was on the most distant terms with the musician and preferred to know nothing concerning her. She had once been almost as emphatic in expressing herself upon the subject as the grocery owner. Edna knew that Madame Lebrun had returned to the city, for it was the middle of November, and she also knew where the Lebrun lived, on Chartres Street. Their home, from the outside, looked like a prison, with iron bars before the door and lower windows. The iron bars were a relic of an old regime, and no one had ever thought of dislodging them. At the side was a high fence enclosing the garden. A gate or door opening upon the street was locked. Edna rang the bell at the side garden gate and stood upon the banquette, waiting to be admitted. It was Victor who opened the gate for her. A black woman, wiping her hands upon her apron, was close at his heels. Before she saw them, Edna could hear them in altercation. The woman, plainly an anomaly, claiming the right to be allowed to perform her duties, one of which was to answer the bell. Victor was surprised and delighted to see Mrs. Pontellier, and he made no attempt to conceal either his astonishment or his delight. He was a dark brown, good-looking youngster of 19, greatly resembling his mother, but with 10 times her impetuosity. He instructed the black woman to go at once and inform Madame Lebrun that Mrs. Pontellier desired to see her. The woman grumbled a refusal to do part of her duty when she had not been permitted to do it at all, and started back to her interrupted task of weeding the garden, whereupon Victor administered a rebuke in the form of a volley of abuse which, owing to its rapidity and incoherence, was all but incomprehensible to Edna. Whatever it was, the rebuke was convincing, for the woman dropped her hoe and went mumbling into the house. Edna did not wish to enter. It was very pleasant there on the side porch, where there were chairs, a wicker lounge, and a small table. She seated herself, for she was tired from her long tramp, and she began to rock gently and smooth out the folds of her silk parasol. Victor drew up his chair beside her. He at once explained that the black woman's offensive conduct was all due to imperfect training, as he was not there to take her in hand. He had only come up from the island the morning before and expected to return the next day. He stayed all winter at the island. He lived there and kept the place in order and got things ready for the summer visitors. But a man needed occasional relaxation, he informed Mrs. Pontellier, and every now and again he drummed up a pretext to bring him to the city. My, but he had had a time of it in the evening before. He wouldn't want his mother to know, and he began to talk in a whisper. He was scintillant recollections. Of course, he couldn't think of telling Mrs. Pontellier all about it, she being a woman and not comprehending such things. But it all began with a girl peeping and smiling at him through the shutters as he passed by. Oh, but she was a beauty. Certainly, he smiled back and went up and talked to her. Mrs. Pontellier did not know him if she supposed he was one to let an opportunity like that escape him. Despite herself, the youngster amused her. She must have betrayed in her look some degree of interest or entertainment. The boy grew more daring, and Mrs. Pontellier might have found herself in a little while listening to a highly colored story, but for the timely appearance of Madame Lebrun. That lady was still clad in white, according to her custom of the summer. Her eyes beamed an effusive welcome. Would not Mrs. Pontellier go inside? How she partaked of some refreshment? Why had she not been there before? How was that dear Mr. Pontellier, and how were their sweet children? Had Mrs. Pontellier ever known such a warm November? Victor went and reclined on the wicker lounge behind his mother's chair, where he commanded a view of Edna's face. He had taken her parasol from her hands while he spoke to her, and now he lifted it and twirled it above him as he lay on his back. When Madame Lebrun complained that it was so dull coming back to the city, that she saw so few people now, that even Victor, when he came up from the island for a day or two, had so much to occupy him and engage in time. Then it was that the youth went into contortions on the lounge and winked slyly at Edna. She somehow felt like a confederate in crime and tried to look severe and disapproving. There had been but 2 letters from Robert, with little in them. They told her, and Victor said it was really not worthwhile to go inside for the letters when his mother entreated him to go and search for them. He remembered the contents, which in truth he rattled off very glibly when put to the test. 1 letter was written from Veracruz and the other from the city of Mexico. He had met Montel, which was doing everything towards his advancement. So far, the financial situation was no improvement over the one he had left in New Orleans, but of course the prospects were vastly better. He wrote of the city of Mexico and the buildings, the people and their habits, the condition of life which he found there. He sent his love to the family. He enclosed a check to his mother and hoped that she would affectionately remember him to all his friends. That was about the substance of the two letters. Edna felt that if there had been a message for her, she would have received it. The despondent frame of mind in which she had left home began again to overtake her, and she remembered that she wished to find Mademoiselle Reiss. Madame Lebrun knew where Mademoiselle Reiss lived. She gave Edna the address, regretting that she would not consent to stay and spend the remainder of the afternoon, and pay a visit to Mademoiselle Reiss some other day. The afternoon was already well advanced. Victor escorted her out upon the banquette, lifted her parasol, and held it over her while he walked to the car with her. He entreated her to bear in mind that the disclosures of the afternoon were strictly confidential. She laughed and bantered him a little, remembering too late that she should have been dignified and reserved. "How handsome Mrs. Pontellier looked," said Madame Lebrun to her son. "Ravishing," he admitted. "The city atmosphere has improved her. In some ways she doesn't seem like the same woman." End of chapter 16-20. Read by Dr. Carolyn Mercier for LibriVox, June 2006.